From KLCC Studios, this is Oregon on the Record.
I'm Michael Dunn. Oregon has been a growth state for so long that it's sometimes easy to forget that our population has hit a stagnation point recently. Part of that issue is that birth rates in Oregon have been receding, and that decline is now manifesting itself in lower enrollment in our schools. Locally, all of our school districts are feeling that decline in the form of strapped budgets. After all, fewer students means fewer dollars from the state. Today on the show, we check in with the education reporter at the Register Guard to talk about the budget challenges facing the Springfield School District and the pushback the board and administrators are getting from angry students and parents. Then, in the last part of the show, we check in with our own Love Cross, who will be launching a new series about emergency preparedness. It seems that every sector of our community is dealing with budget challenges, but right now our education system might be leading the pack. Earlier this week, we talked about the budget situation at Eugene's 4J. Today, we talk with a reporter at the Register Guard about the bleak financial picture in Springfield schools. Miranda Sear, who covers education for the Register Guard. Miranda, always great to see you. Thanks for coming in.
Yeah, thanks for having me again.
Yeah. Well, why don't you tell us, kind of give us the overview of what's going on with the Springfield schools and certainly their budget challenges.
Yeah, so there's a lot going on with Springfield Public Schools right now, with a lot of different levels going on. Mm-hmm. Obviously, the most present issue, I think, in everyone's mind right now is the recent layoffs that were caused by necessary budget cuts. So they were facing a $2.34 million shortfall. And, you know, a lot of school districts in the state, even across the country, are facing budget issues due to declining enrollment. You know, Springfield Public Schools is down 2,000 students over the past 10 years, which is about 17% of their student enrollment, which is a huge number, obviously. You know, the district has said that the reason for these layoffs, which there were 27 full-time equivalent positions laid off, and those will go into effect at the end of this week, actually.
Wow.
And then there's 4.5 additional cuts to unfilled positions. It's a little complicated how they factor that in.
Perhaps people who don't pay attention to school districts might think, oh, well, if you have less students, you don't need as much money. But explain how, obviously, it's not that simple because less students means less funding, right, from the state.
Yeah, exactly. There's this calculator that ODE uses and how it distributes funds to school districts, and that is based on enrollment. Obviously, if all school districts are down in enrollment, it's not as big of an issue.
Okay.
But Lane County Schools in particular, when I was doing research for my enrollment story, they are declining at a faster rate than a lot of other school districts in the state. So there's an issue there. Also, costs are just inflating everywhere. You know, pretty much costs for anything are expensive right now. And there's also the factor that a lot of, you know, educators I've talked with, post-COVID world, students have more needs, social emotional needs, and they need more support in that classroom to be successful. So there's also those expenses that come with that as well.
Yeah. Well, you mentioned it, and I know you had a very big story about declining enrollment. If you can, what are some of the issues that we're looking at here? Why are enrollments declining?
Yeah, so birth rate is kind of the number one driver, obviously. Oregon has you know, the U.S. in general has a birth rate that is lower than the sustainable rate. So the only way that Oregon is actually increasing its population is because of migration in, which doesn't always include kids because, especially here in Lane County, you know, housing prices are really high. So that's something that local officials have talked with me about, high prices of living, not really sustainable for a family.
Yeah. And one of your first stories that caught my attention was the fact that this was unusual in that Springfield announced layoffs mid-year. Talk about that cycle and why that was a pretty big shock, wasn't it?
Yeah, I think it was for a lot of people. I know folks at the union, the Springfield Education Association, they were you know, they were shocked by that. A lot of community members were shocked. And so the district kind of explained that the mid-year cuts are because of the bargaining that SEA is currently undergoing. Mm-hmm. So they're in the midst of bargaining right now. And in their budget for the 2025-26 school year, which I believe they voted on in June of 25, they assumed a 0% cost of living adjustment, bargaining had already started at that point, obviously. Yeah. So I think their most recent offer was 4% COLA. So that meant because of the COLA, they had to have a trade-off of layoffs mid-year. And that was the explanation that they gave. Okay. And, you know, the district laid out kind of a timeline of when they explained that to the union. The union kind of disagrees that it wasn't very clear. So there's definitely some tensions there.
Okay. Let me reintroduce you to the audience, talking to Miranda Sear, who covers education for the Register Guard. Speaking of tension, you've also written stories about there's been a lot of tension at board meetings, teachers, parents, you know, kind of encapsulate some of that, you know, kind of hard feelings that are happening right now.
Yeah, so there is a lot of tension, obviously, mm-hmm. at board meetings, both in the public session, the executive sessions. There's a lot of high emotions. Obviously, there's been quite a few complaints levied against board members specifically, which isn't the most common thing to happen, especially so many in succession. And those complaints have been lodged by even district leaders, including Director of Human Resources Dustin Reese and mm-hmm. Superintendent Todd Hamilton. And those have mainly been against board members Jonathan Light, but also board member Ken Cole. Okay. Board member Amber Langworthy. A lot of it has to do with the dynamics between the board and the district leaders. You know, district leaders have complained about board members going over their heads and doing things that are against the board policy, really.
Okay. School boards can be contentious because obviously you're talking about kids, you know. How did some of the voting come down on, because as I understand it, the board has to approve these kind of layoffs. Maybe give us a picture of how those decisions and how the voting went on with regard to layoffs.
Yeah, so for the layoff vote, it was a split vote. Mm-hmm. So three board members, Ken Cole, Nicole DeGraff, and Heather Kwas-Ansa, mm-hmm. they all voted in favor of the layoffs. Then two board members voted against, which was Jonathan Light and Amber Langworthy.
Okay.
And so actually there's been a movement in the community now to recall the three board members who voted in favor of the layoffs. And that is led by, I believe, Kai Fireside, who's running for John Lively's representative position.
I see.
As well as Devin Lawson, who previously ran for the Lane Community College board.
Boy, I sometimes wonder why anybody would want to be a school board member, but it's great that people do run for the position. You know, so what's the timing of all this? Is some of it's already happened, some of it's going to happen? Lay out kind of how this very, very difficult cuts are going to roll out into the rest of the school year and whatnot.
Yeah, so these cuts will go into effect on January 31st, which is right at the semester break.
Okay.
So, you know, those 27 individuals who were laid off, this is their last week in the classroom. But beyond that, there's also quite a few teachers are being shuffled around the district to fill in those gaps left behind by the teacher layoffs. So I talked with someone from A3, which is the alternative high school in Springfield, mm-hmm. and they are being moved to Hamlin Middle School very suddenly. They said they've never even stepped foot in Hamlin. You know, they have been at A3 for 10 years and their students are devastated. They're devastated. So a lot of students and staff are being impacted by this.
Yeah. As best you can, you know, encapsulate for us, because you talk to so many educators and whatnot, what's morale like? I mean, being a teacher is a difficult job in the best of circumstances. What's it like with all of this hanging over their heads, as best you can tell?
Yeah, so in speaking with the union leaders, morale isn't great. I think one of the leaders said it wasn't great before, but this has been a really tough blow. You know, they had a vigil last week, which was kind of mourning the loss of the staff that were laid off. And there was a big show out there. There was about 100 people. Yeah, it seems like people are frustrated, confused. A lot of people are expressing a desire to have had more communication and more of a chance to figure out alternatives with the district. There's also a petition, I think it's called Springfield Bridge Plan, that has like alternatives to layoffs. But you know, at this point, it seems unlikely that that will happen.
Yeah. I saw in one of your pieces as well, there's kind of like a lottery system with regard to the layoffs. Can you explain that?
Yeah, so the lottery system is part of Oregon law. So essentially, when there is layoffs due to budget issues, they can't necessarily pick and choose any teacher because then it would be, you know, for cause. And this is not necessarily for cause, these layoffs. And so the lottery works with calculating the start date for a teacher, which is the first day they're in the classroom. So obviously, a lot of teachers are starting the first day all at the same time. So they put that into a lottery system where they have the names, and then it's kind of a randomized situation. So really, I mean, it's a broad range of, of folks that were affected, most in the middle school positions were affected.
I know you also cover what's going on in 4J. And I wonder, are there comparisons? Obviously, enrollment, like you said, it crosses over every single school district boundary. But are there some unique challenges to Springfield that maybe Eugene's 4J isn't going through? Or is it basically, it's kind of all the same thing, just different district?
Yeah, it seems like, well, for 4J, obviously, they have a much, much bigger budget shortfall that they're facing. I mean, you know, 10 times over, just about. 4J is facing a $30 million budget shortfall. They're looking at, you know, 269 up to FTE being cut versus, you know.
Yeah, 26 or whatever you
said. Yeah, 27 at Springfield. So obviously, I mean, there's a huge deficit there. But that just goes to show, I mean, between 4J, you know, those cuts that will be coming, we don't know the full details on what's going to happen there. Springfield, University of Oregon, there's all these educators that are going to be out of a job in Lane County. And so I just wonder kind of what the future is for those educators and for education in Lane County, really, because that's going to be a huge, huge.
School closures. Is that on the table?
At Springfield, I mean, I haven't heard anything. Not that I know of at all. Obviously, Bethel has a closure that they're looking at this year, Shasta Middle School. 4J, no school closures, but there is that co-location of Camas Ridge Community School and Family School, the alternative elementary. So we'll see how that goes. I know there's been some contention there as well.
Yeah. So this, for lack of a better phrase, almost like a rolling blackout of enrollment, you know, where does this end? I mean, is this something that, you know, in talking to both, you know, the school districts that you cover, but also up to the University of Oregon, I mean, are educators thinking, well, there's going to be a time when enrollment bounces back, or we just don't know?
I mean, at this point, with the birth rate, again, not going up. You know, I talked with some folks at the Population Research Center up in Portland, at the Portland State University. There doesn't seem to be any bounce back anytime soon, which doesn't indicate an increase again. There is that sort of like quote unquote enrollment cliff that is happening right around now. It's either this past year of seniors, high school seniors, or this coming class of high school seniors. And then from there on out, it's just a downward slope of enrollment, which is obviously going to have an impact on higher education as well. You know, both U of O and LCC are facing concerns over enrollment, and even more so than public K-12 schools, that enrollment and the tuition is really make or break for higher education. So, yeah, there's definitely a lot of concern from folks in education across the board.
Yeah. She covers education for the Register Guard. Miranda Sear, thank you so much for what you do and for coming in and talking about it.
She's the voice of Morning Radio in Western and Central Oregon, but today she's the voice of emergency preparedness, and she joins us now. Hey, love, it's great to see you. Thanks for coming in.
Hey, thanks for having me, Michael.
Yeah, I'm really excited to talk about this because obviously in Oregon, we do have to prepare for a lot. You know, preparing for disasters means being ready for wildfires, prepping for extreme weather, events like floods, and of course, we remember the ice storm, and of course, preparing for the big one, a Cascadian subduction zone earthquake. Tell us about Oregon Ready and why you wanted to take this on.
Well, at its core, the series is really about how we can all take very small steps to ensure we're better prepared for a disaster, any of those that you just mentioned. And when we think about disaster preparedness, it can really feel intimidating and overwhelming. And so in Oregon, we do talk a lot about being 2 weeks ready, because after a major disaster, that's about how long it could take for help to arrive. I realized that I wasn't quite 2 weeks ready myself, and I wanted to understand what actually helps people move from that intention to action. So that's really the catalyst behind Oregon Ready. Every month, we'll be digging into different pieces of preparedness, like go bags, pet planning, neighborhood support groups, and more. I am inviting our KLCC listeners and readers to join me in this personal preparedness journey. It's really more about learning together than about lecturing.
Okay. I've heard this term, 2 weeks ready, but what does it actually mean?
So at its most basic level, when you're 2 weeks ready, it means having enough supplies, information, and planning to essentially support yourself and your household for about 2 weeks. So that's things like food, water, medications, cash, of course, a plan for evacuation or sheltering in place. And it's not about fearing a disaster and being without for 2 weeks. It's kind of about buying time in a crisis like that.
Yeah, and you've fully admitted you're not fully prepared yet, are you?
That's right. You know, I started thinking about my own preparedness, and I realized that I'm a few days ready, maybe not 2 weeks ready. When we had that ice storm in 2024, my family was fine. We didn't lose power. We had plenty of food and supplies, and we were warm, but it's not always going to be in those types of situations. Sure. So I started realizing that I should probably take this a little more seriously. I started having conversations with people while planning the series, and I admit, you know I should be more prepared, and I'm not. And when I tell people that, the response I'm getting is same. Like, people are saying, me too. So a lack of preparedness, it seems like, can feel a little bit like a personal failing, when really I look at it more of a systems problem. We're busy, we're overwhelmed, and we're just not quite sure where to start. So as I kick this thing off, I spoke with Jenny Damaris. She's the emergency management specialist with the Eugene Water and Electric Board. And let me tell you, Michael, if there is someone who knows emergency preparedness, it's Jenny. Before coming to EWEB, she served as the Lincoln County Emergency Manager for 12 years. And even she admitted that procrastination plays a large role in disaster prep.
I will use myself as an example. I bought a new car this year. Does it have everything I need in my car kit, being the most prepared emergency manager in the state? No, it actually does not. I've got bottles of water. I've got an extra jacket. Do I have any extra food? I don't. Do I have extra gloves? I was thinking this morning, it was cold. I don't have a hat in my car. So give yourself some grace about where you're at in your planning process, and just keep moving forward. A little at a time is really going to get you to that end result. And it may take you 12 or 14 months to feel like you're really ready, and that's okay. The more you do, the better prepared you are.
I think that's such an important piece of this, what she just said there, to give yourself grace and know that any little things you do to move closer to being 2 weeks ready is really better than doing nothing at all.
Well, what I'm really excited about is this series, it's going to help people sort of know where to start, right?
That's exactly right. And in exploring resources for how to get myself started with this, I discovered that EWEB has developed a 12-month preparedness program. They call it the Pledge to Prepare. year, they've essentially broken down steps into a month-by-month approach. For example, January involves getting 3 days of food and water, learning how to sanitize and store water, which is very important, as we'll learn. February adds to that with an additional day of food and water and looking at propane or alternative food prep or heat sources, and then so on and so forth each month. Once I looked at this in these increments, it really stopped feeling overwhelming, and I heard similar sentiments from people who attended an information session about the Pledge to Prepare program this month, and I'll be sharing their voices as well.
Now, I know you're just kicking this off, this series, but some things you've learned already?
Well, something that's really stuck with me already is that the more people can take care of themselves for those first couple of weeks, local governments and first responders can focus on people who are elderly, medically vulnerable, or displaced. So when you think of it in that way, it feels like preparedness isn't just a personal journey and about making sure you're prepared, but it's actually an act of community care. And I had never really considered it in that way.
Yeah, yeah. Mm-hmm. So for people listening right now, maybe what's one small step they could take just right now, today?
Well, today, just take stock of what you already have. Most people are closer than they think. They just don't have things organized or accessible. Even knowing where your flashlight and important documents are is a solid first step. If you're someone who goes camping often, you probably have a lot of the emergency supplies, because when you're out camping, you're kind of sheltering in place, you know, in a different environment. So just take stock of what you have, starting to think about how you can organize those so that you have better access to them in case of an emergency.
Yeah, and I'm sure people listening right now are getting excited about this. So how can they get involved and learn more?
Well, I really hope they will. So my hope is that you, our KLCC listeners and readers at klcc.org, will join me and follow along over this next year and become better prepared themselves. I invite questions and thoughts on disaster preparedness. You can send an email to questions@klcc.org. We'll be sharing resources and stories on the air and online. I really want elements of the series to be shaped by the community. So again, you can send your thoughts to questions@klcc.org and tune into Morning Edition tomorrow. I'll be bringing you our first piece in this series. And you know, Michael, I hope you'll join me too.
Count me in. Count me in. Love, it's always great to talk to you. This is an exciting program. We'll be checking in with you. Thanks so much for coming in.
Thanks for having me, Michael.
That's the show for today. All episodes of Oregon on the Record are available as a podcast at klcc.org. They don't have a roster, but Oregon's new WNBA team has a schedule, and tomorrow on the show, we talk to OPB's Kyra Buckley about the excitement brewing around the Portland Fire. Before we go, in an episode we aired Monday where we discussed Eugene's 4J school district's budget situation, a KLCC reporter inaccurately described students as being placed in family school. Family school is a choice school that provides more opportunities for parent involvement and alternative learning styles. I'm Michael Dunn, host of Oregon on the Record. Thanks for listening.